Grant paused in the act of turning the thing over to consider the face a moment longer. A judge? A soldier? A prince? Someone used to great responsibility and responsible in his authority. Someone too conscientious. A warrior. Perhaps a perfectionist. Someone too who had suffered ill health as a child. He had that incommunicable, that indescribable look that childhood suffering leaves behind it. He turned the portrait over to look for a caption. On the back was printed, Richard III. Now that is Josephine Tay's novel, The Daughter of Time, published in 1951. It's often described as one of the greatest whodunits ever written. It's the book that effectively kick-started the kind of Ricardian romance with Richard III, and it is by far the most celebrated attempt to solve the mystery of the princes in the tower. Tom Holland, until now, because now the rest is history, will tread in Josephine Tay's footsteps and we will solve the mystery, won't we?
Well, yes, I'm sure we'll come to this when we look at how people have understood the mystery of the princes in the tower. But that thing in Josephine Tay's novel that Richard looks a kind of kind man.
He's very kind. So the head of the lady who discovered Richard III in that car park in Leicester, Philippa Langley, she yes. famously said, didn't she, when she saw a portrait of Richard III, I think she says it in the documentary, is that the face of a tyrant? Such a kind face.
Yes. Which I have to say, when you look, because it's a reconstruction, isn't it, based on the
that's right.
the,
yes,
the body, the skull that was found. I think when you look at him, it was terrifying. Looks actually rather like Laurence Olivier in the...
Yes, he does, actually. Well, that's because they've given him Olivier's wig, though, haven't they?
Anyway, we'll come on to all that. But welcome back to the second half of our episode on the princes in the tower. And Dominic, in the first half, basically, he's only just become king, Edward V.
Yeah. So we should pick up on the 9th of April, 1483, shouldn't we? So Edward IV has died, and he's left two sons, Edward, 12, Richard, 9. Richard, he's with his mother, isn't he, in London?
Yeah, in London.
But Edward is in Ludlow with his uncle, Anthony Woodville, Lord Rivers. And then he has another uncle, Richard of Gloucester, who is basically the boss
running
of
the
north.
Yeah.
Who's up in the north. So at the moment
Midland that Edward, Castle,
Edward IV dies, there is a degree of... Well, there isn't necessarily uncertainty. Straight away what happens is a council meets, doesn't it? And they agree... Fine, Edward IV has died. We'll have the coronation of Edward V on the 4th of May. But the issue is he's too young to rule in his own right at the age of 12. So obviously there's some uncertainty about who's actually
going to basically... So basically there's 4 years, isn't there?
So not long, but long enough, I suppose, to entrench your networks and to use the power of patronage. Who's going to control the machine between now and then? That's the question. Well, there are two things, aren't there? Who's going to control the machine? And who is going to have control access to the young king? Because those are two slightly different issues.
Okay, so we have two questions, which I think go together very well. One from Joe Johnson. Was there any scenario in which the Woodvilles or the council could have outmaneuvered Richard to protect the prince's succession? Or was Richard just too powerful and the prince's fate was sealed as soon as Edward IV died? And Robert Elliot, did Richard have his eye on the crown from the moment Edward IV died? Or was it only when he realised Edward V would never forgive him? So, you know, massive spoiler alert there.
Yeah.
Of course, everyone listening to this episode will know that Richard ends up taking the crown.
Yeah. So those
Edward
two...
Edward V vanishes into the tower. But was it inevitable that was going to happen? Was Richard always planning to usurp the crown? That's basically the plot of Richard III.
Yeah.
The plot of Richard III, Richard is trying to get rid of everyone who stands in the way of him. You know, he murders everybody. And that clearly seems to... I mean, that's clearly not the case. But... When Edward IV dies, does Richard think, okay, this is my chance to become king?
I would say no, Tom.
I would say too.
Absolutely no.
Yeah,
I would too. I think there's no evidence to suggest that Richard is thinking of becoming king before his brother dies. And I would say, now the interesting thing is that the common portrait of Richard III is the sort of the Shakespeare portrait. He's incredibly cunning and conniving, and he's planning everything long in advance. He's playing a very long game. I don't think there's any evidence for that. I think he is...
He's as caught short as everybody else.
From the moment his brother dies, he is scrambling, as they all are, to find their place in the new world. And he's constantly improvising. I think some of his biographers have pointed this out, that actually he doesn't seem to have a long-term strategy. He is constantly grasping for kind of short-term solutions, which often cause then problems of their own further down the line. So he'll make and break alliances, pick people up and drop them, all of these kinds of things.
However, there is kind of a warning from history, from the reign of Henry VI, who, of course, was even younger than Edward V. So had to have a kind of protector. And that role was taken on by Humphrey, the Duke of Gloucester, who's the youngest brother of Henry V. And it doesn't end well for him. His wife gets accused of witchcraft. He gets kind of dragged down in scandal. He's chiefly remembered now for setting up a library in Oxford. So Richard knows that the role of protector is a treacherous one. And it's all the more treacherous if there are kind of rival factions who hate you.
So the other question, isn't it? The Joe Johnson's question. Yes. Could the Woodvilles have outmaneuvered Richard? Now, maybe you'll disagree with me about this, Tom. I don't know. I would say, yes, there clearly is a scenario in which the Woodvilles win the day. And I would say that not by looking backwards, but by looking forwards, as we did a little bit in the last episode. So this is not massively dissimilar from the position when Henry VIII dies. He also has a very young heir in Edward VI, who has a parvenu family around him, the Seymours. Now, what happens with Henry VIII and that succession? He takes longer to die. So the Seymours have lots of time to get all their kind of their forces lined up. They also have a little bit of a coup before Henry VIII dies to get rid of their factional rival, the Duke of Norfolk and stuff. So as soon as Henry VIII dies, they move into position. Their troops seal off roads. They take possession of the young king. They sort it all out. And basically, you know, it's fine. Yeah. They win the day. Now, the Woodvilles don't do that, I think, partly because they don't have time, but also arguably because they are less ruthless. They are insufficiently ruthless, I would say.
Yeah, I think so.
They don't identify Richard as they don't identify two people. One is Richard and the other is a man called Hastings.
Yes. So I think a further reason why they can't coordinate is that the two key Woodvilles, so Elizabeth, the Queen, and Anthony, her brother, are separate. The Queen is in London, and Anthony, Lord Rivers, is in Ludlow.
Yeah, it's a big problem.
So you mentioned
that he's in Ludlow.
You mentioned Hastings.
He'd been a chamberlain. Sorry, I didn't finish my sentence.
Hastings is the big. We've talked about the rivalries between the Woodvilles and Richard, which obviously are the kind of titanic ones. But there are other factions within the Yorkist court as well. And Hastings is a key player. He's been a kind of loyal supporter of Edward IV right the way through. In fact, he kind of takes a bribe from Elizabeth Woodville right back in 1464 when she is angling to meet Edward IV. And ever since then, there's been kind of tension between them. But Elizabeth Woodville and Hastings do kind of try and arrive at an accommodation. Obviously, they can't do it with reference to Richard because he's up in the north, but they kind of arrive at an agreement that that all the people who come into London should have small retinues so that you're not getting large armies kind of congregating on.
Because they don't want another outbreak of the Wars of the Roses kind of scenario where people pitch up with little armies.
Exactly. And so that shows that that Hastings and the Woodvilles are kind of trying to arrive at an accommodation. There's a kind of famous scene in Shakespeare's play where Edward's on his deathbed and he obliges all the various factions to kind of kiss and make up.
I think that's true, actually, Tom, isn't that?
I think it is true.
There's chronicle evidence for that.
Yeah.
And just to go back to the factions, with the question we had last episode, is this Edward IV's great sort of downfall, is that his failing as a king. I mean, my answer to that would be, remember, the factions are always going to be there. There's always going to be all this competition for lands, for estates, for offices, at the kind of often starting at a very, very local level. You see it in the Paston Letters and things, this yeah. famous kind of medieval source. So it's inevitable there's going to be a degree of rivalry. The question is, I suppose, what they all have to calculate is, are we all going to, is there anybody with an ulterior motive? When people talk about compromise, do they mean it? If they don't mean it, should I strike first or should I do nothing?
Well, you could absolutely
nothing?
See, did you ever play the game Kingmaker?
No, I know the game you mean.
Sensational board game, which kind of revolves around all these kind of tensions. You know, who do you make alliances with? Who do you kill? All this kind of stuff. And you can see why, you know, this... such dramatic material for Shakespeare, and then the influence that those plays have had on mafia dramas or whatever. I mean, it is a very tense scenario. But so essentially what's agreed is that Elizabeth Woodville and Hastings in London are trying to arrive at accommodation. There's the council as well in London, yeah. and they're also part of it. The question is what's going to happen to the young king's two uncles. And they agree that they will... rendezvous at Northampton.
That's right. So Richard and Anthony Woodville. Anthony Woodville is bringing Edward with him, and Richard is coming south, and they will meet in Northampton. Now, Richard is also going to meet another person who we haven't mentioned at all,
yeah.
who is the Duke of Buckingham. And Buckingham had been Edward IV's ward. He's a sort of, he's a landowner in the sort of, in the Welsh Marches. He's got a big place at Brecon called Brecknock. He's a slightly disaffected figure, slightly on the fringes of the regime, isn't he?
Well, he, like the House of York and like the House of Lancaster, is descended from Edward III.
Yeah, so he has a very, very tenuous...
very tenuous claim. And he's married to Catherine Woodville, who is one of the Queen's sisters.
Yeah, so he's kind of part of the world, but he's slightly on the outside, but he's ambitious, isn't he? He's
and he was brought up
ambitious.
With Richard, wasn't he?
Yeah.
They know each other well.
But he's never been a player, particularly till now.
Yeah.
Going back, just a quick question, to Robert Elliott's thing about Richard. Is Richard, as he comes south, is he thinking, right, I need to plan this to get my hands on the crown? I would say no.
Richard, I need to get my hands on the king.
What he's thinking is he's been running the north. He has all his people that he knows in the north and people who owe him loyalty. And he owes them his protection. You know, that's the way this works. That's the way the system works. So his guiding principle, I think, is how can I protect my own position and make sure that I don't end up being killed and that my people stripped of all their estates and my family thrown out in the cold? I think that's what's driving him. They're all driven as much, I think, by fear as they are by greed or ambition or any of those things.
And I think there's no question as to what his answer to that question is, which to begin with is not to take the crown himself, but to take control of the young king.
Yeah.
And we know that because of what happens, which is that on the 29th of April, they all meet up at Stony Stratford, which is just outside.
Well, the Woodvilles are in Stony Stratford, but this is crucial, actually.
And
he's in Northampton,
and Richard and Buckingham arrives late.
That's right.
And Richard and Buckingham kind of plot.
Well, so Richard's already met. So the Woodvilles, they've left Edward at Stony Stratford with his retinue. They go into Northampton for a meeting with Richard. And apparently at that meeting, he has a very cheerful and merry face. So that all seems to go well. Buckingham arrives late. And then we know that Richard and Buckingham sit up late into the night talking. And then
the next morning,
everything changes, doesn't it?
So Anthony Woodville wakes up to find that his... bed and breakfast, his Airbnb is surrounded. So too does Edward V's half-brother, Sir Richard Grey. So
yeah.
The youngest son of Elizabeth Woodville before she married Edward IV. And they're arrested. And Richard and Buckingham go to see Edward V. And they say that Rivers was not just a traitor, but morally disreputable. And this is what something that Richard is very, very keen on. He's very hostile to displays of vice and very, very keen on kind of playing the defender of morality.
Well, clearly, by the standards of the day, although he has illegitimate children.
Yeah,
of his
own. Sure.
He's quite a prurient kind of person.
Sure.
That really comes out from his piety.
But I think it's clear that Anthony Woodville was an effective guardian. And this actually is precisely the problem, because when Richard goes and tells Edward the Fifth, your guardian is a disgrace, he's a traitor, we've got to get rid of him, but it's fine, I'm going to look after you. Edward the Fifth says, no.
Yeah.
He was great. I think he's wonderful. I love
him. There's a point here, isn't there, Tom?
I think this is the key moment.
Isn't there a point here, though, where it occurred to me, if Edward V had been younger, this wouldn't have been so much of a problem.
Exactly.
So if he'd been five, he would have sort of said, oh, okay.
Oh, fine, okay.
And off they'd have gone to London. But 12 is quite old.
Absolutely.
And clearly he just listens to what his uncle, who he hasn't probably seen that much of.
Not at all. He's listened to his other uncle, River. He likes the problem is that he sides with Rivers.
Yeah, clearly.
And this is a problem.
That's a definite problem.
And I think that everything follows from that, because the fact that Richard is confronted with the nightmare prospect that, you know, the lessons of history teach him, which is that Once a king comes of age,
he'll turn.
It's very, very bad news for the protector, and especially if there are rival factions.
Of course. Now, Tom, I'll tell you a quick fact, by the way, about this coup in Northamptonshire. So the key family around Northamptonshire at that time is a family called the Wake family. If you've read Tom Penn's book, The Brothers York, mm-hmm. which describes
It's a wonderful
this,
book.
He talks quite a lot about the Wake family. They are still in Northamptonshire. And the heir to the dynasty is a listener to this podcast.
Oh, goodness.
Johnny Wake.
How do you know that?
Because his children are at school with my son.
Oh, that's brilliant. So this is living history.
I was very excited when I discovered that. And hopefully he will be too. Although his family took part in a coup that ended up with some infanticide, whether maybe he won't appreciate me mentioning it.
Who knows?
Anyway, so yes, so Richard has taken possession of Edward. Now, Tom, we didn't mention that what Elizabeth Woodville is doing with Richard of York, because obviously when word of this...
Oh, she's straight off to Sanctuary again.
She reads the runes.
Yeah,
I mean,
course.
You're a big fan of hers, I know.
Her brother has been taken off to Pontefract, which, as anyone familiar with the reign of Richard II will know, terrible if you get taken to Pontefract. You're almost bound to die, because that's where Richard II gets murdered. So, yes, Elizabeth is straight off to Westminster again.
And in a way, that's a sign. She recognises straight away what's going on. And she can see that once Richard of Gloucester has taken that first step, which I think he's taken for completely understandable reasons, he wants to protect himself from the Woodville. So once he's taken that first step of securing the king,
he's on the escalator.
Because I mean, you could argue he's been on the escalator from day one, though, couldn't you?
But what then happens? Because again, he comes to London, he goes to the council. And he tells the council to condemn Rivers as a traitor. And the council basically turn around and say, well, where's your evidence? And it's exactly as when Richard has confronted Edward V, and Edward V says, well, I like Rivers. But despite that, the council kind of go along with Richard. He's clearly the grand fromage now in the Yorkist court.
Yeah, because it's about a month, isn't there?
Yeah.
4th of May till the 13th of June, where he's the boss. Everything seems like it might calm down. Do you not think in that period?
Except
sort of
that two crucial steps are taken, presumably, you know, absolutely led by Richard, one of which is to postpone Edward V's coronation to the 22nd of June.
That's right.
So that's postponed. And the other, notoriously, is he should be lodged in the Tower.
But Tom,
and that's not inherently sinister.
That's not that ominous, because at that point, there's no record of killing people in the Tower particularly. I mean, some people have
Henry
died
the
in
sixth,
the Tower.
Henry
the sixth. Okay. But the Tower...
It is a prison as well as a royal residence.
It is, but I think when people hear that about the Tower, they think about Henry VIII and his wives, and they think, oh, it means the chopping block. It doesn't.
It's
the main royal complex in London. I think the scary thing for Edward V and for people, his sort of pals, is that he is surrounded by Richard's men. Richard has total control of him at this stage. So he's cut off from the Woodvilles. His uncle is in captivity, and he is utterly at the mercy of Richard's guards. That's the sort of scary thing. But at that point, Does he think he's in danger of his life? Surely not.
Well, Richard wants... So on the 10th of June, he summons basically a massive army from the north. So the entire agreement that people wouldn't bring in large armies, Richard parks that.
Yeah.
And we talked about Blackadder.
Yeah.
It's taken by Sir Richard Ratcliffe, who is played in the Ian McKellen film of Richard III by Tim McEnany, who's Darling.
Oh, right. Percy, and then
yeah,
Percy, Darling.
Yeah. So a little connection there.
3 days later, isn't it, that you start to get, you had this incredible scene which Shakespeare famously, brilliantly recreates, where, because the other key figure has been Hastings, who was basically the ultimate Edward IV loyalist.
Yeah.
And
he's loyal to the house.
I think clearly stands for compromise. So I think, reading between the lines, what's happened is that in the days just leading up to this council meeting on the 13th of June, Richard has probably sounded out Hastings and said, you know, where do we go from here? I could be king, you know, I don't have to be, but I could be. You know, and maybe that would sort it all out.
You know,
and we could kind of knock out the Woodvilles completely, just take them out of the equation if I'm king and you can be number two or something. And Hastings probably said, no, I think Edward V has to be king.
Because he's loyal to Edward IV and therefore to the line. And ultimately, his loyalty to Edward IV is greater than his hostility to Elizabeth Woodville. And so therefore, he is an Edward V loyalist.
And I think at that point, Richard thinks, it's that classic thing that we saw with Vitellius.
Yeah.
Richard thinks, oh God, well, if he's not going to be on my side, what am I going to do?
I have to kill him now.
And so, I think that's absolutely what happens.
It's interesting. So in Shakespeare's play, Richard says, look, you know, I've been bewitched, and shows his withered arm.
Yeah.
But actually, it's what he's doing is he's accusing Elizabeth Woodville of using witchcraft against him.
Yeah.
And that's obviously calculated to get Hastings on board, because Hastings hates the Woodvilles. But Hastings hesitates and says no. And so Richard has him executed.
Yes, he does. And one of Hastings' man, it's interesting, the sort of Game of Thrones type dimension, because Hastings' great deputy was a man called Sir William Catesby. And he ditches Hastings at this point. Clearly, Richard has suborned him in some way. He turns on Hastings. And Hastings is effectively, he's basically dragged out of the council, isn't he? And taken off to the chopping block.
Yeah, yeah. And then 3 days later, again, kind of... in the Olivier film, brilliant scene when the young Richard of Shrewsbury is released by Elizabeth Woodville.
So he's the nine-year-old brother,
the younger
prince.
And there's a kind of a terrifying exchange between them where the little boy jokes with Richard, and Richard kind of fixes him with his stare. Very, very sinister moment. Whether it seems sinister to people, but I mean, people must be starting to...
Well, presumably at this point, so Elizabeth Woodville hands her son over out of sanctuary to join his older brother in the tower. And presumably she does this because she thinks, okay,
the coronation is going ahead.
At this point, well, she thinks Richard is clearly determined. He's going to be a protector. He's going to be the big man. The thing to do now is appease him.
Yeah.
You know, give him my younger son. The coronation is still on. The coronation is still supposedly going to happen on the 22nd of June. But as soon as Richard Senior has got hold of the little boy, he says, actually, no, the coronation is not going to happen until November now.
Yeah.
And at that point, you're like, is it ever going to happen?
Yes. and then there's a sermon preached on the 22nd of June, isn't there?
Yeah, Ralph Shaw. And he says, I mean, they have two arguments, don't they? Not even just one, which is clearly a sign that you know your arguments are...
a bad one.
Yeah. So first of all, this guy says, Edward IV... was completely illegitimate anyway. He was a bastard. So Richard basically accuses his own mother of sleeping around. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cecily Neville. He says, you know, she wasn't as faithful to my father anyway. I mean, Edward IV wasn't even my brother.
And look at Clarence as well. Because he says Edward and Clarence didn't look anything like their father.
Yeah.
But I do.
But then the other argument is... He wasn't married to Elizabeth Woodville anyway, because there'd been a pre-contract with another woman, Eleanor Talbot, later.
Who's conveniently dead.
Yeah. So not only is he a bastard, my brother, but my nephews are bastards too.
I think even the most devoted Ricardian has some, you know, it's a guy who's prepared to kind of say that about his mother simply so that he can displace his nephew.
He's desperate though at this point, don't you think?
Yes, but it's poor form, Dominic.
I suppose it is poor form.
Don't you think? I mean, I don't think that's not filial behaviour.
No, it's not filial. I mean, it's definitely not very filial behaviour. And I think pretty much straight afterwards, the Duke of Buckingham, who's this sort of Weasley figure we mentioned earlier, who's basically attached himself to Richard as chief ally, he goes to the Guildhall, doesn't he? And orchestrates these calls. Again. Says, oh, we should give Richard the...
Brilliant in the play.
The guards all sort of, hurrah, yeah, what a great idea. Yeah. Basically being, you know, given a groat each or something to shout this. And then it's all very swift, incredibly swift.
So the 25th of June, the princes are declared illegitimate. And the thing, you know, the further thing that I think marks this out as deeply treacherous is that all these rumours about the illegitimacy of the princes and the illegitimacy of Edward's marriage to Elizabeth Woodville, it all originated in the swirl of kind of calumnies and propaganda that had accompanied the coup against Edward back in 1470.
Yeah, the Warwick coup. Exactly. They're resuscitating old rumours.
They're resuscitating all that.
But is it, Tom, I'm very hesitant to, more hesitant than you are, to say, oh, this is terrible villainy. This is, I think, all it would have taken would be for Richard to have won one battle and we would be telling this story differently, I think. We would be telling it as ruthless.
I don't think so. And
very hard-nosed. But I think we would say, frankly, this is medieval politics. This is what Henry IV did to Richard II.
It's not, though.
The difference is because it's got kids. But that's bad luck. That is Richard's bad luck.
It's nephews. And you think about the other king who murdered his nephew. And I've given away there the fact that I think that Richard is responsible for the murder of the Prince of the Tower. Is John.
Yeah.
And the two kings who have had the worst reputations in English history are John and Richard III. And I think it's no coincidence that they were both at least believed to be guilty of the same crime. And you can argue whether they really were, but that was their reputation.
They're
and
totally
that's why,
different characters, though, Tom.
Of course. But Dominic, the thing is that this is not normal behaviour at all.
Yeah, but it's not a normal position.
Of course it's not.
Richard
and
is in.
I agree. He's firefighting.
If he doesn't do any of the steps, he probably thinks he will die.
I entirely accept that. But I still think that, accusing your mother of sleeping around.
It's like the plot of EastEnders.
It is very. Well, all the while, plotting to get rid of your nephews, resuscitating rumours spread about by your own family's enemies.
You've lost Philippa Langley as a listener. I'll tell you that now.
Probably. But I think then when you throw into that the kind of tone of sanctimony, which I'm sure, you know, is the expression of an authentic Christian sensibility, but it does slightly... It makes him seem an unpleasant figure, I think.
I think since we've been talking for almost half an hour and you're getting more and more judgmental.
Well, hold on.
Let's get him crowned.
Yeah, so let's get him crowned. So the princes are declared illegitimate.
Yeah.
Rivers and Richard Grey are executed at Pontefract. Rivers has written a rather stylish poem and you know, he's very cool even on the chopping block. On the 6th of July, Richard is crowned and lots of people turn up, but lots of people don't. Elizabeth Woodville is not there. And who else is not there?
Well, Edward V is not there. Really interestingly, there had been plans for him to attend the coronation. They had ordered him clothes and shoes and spurs and horses. So weirdly, although he'd been declared illegitimate, he was going to attend his uncle's coronation, which I suppose would have been the ultimate kind of affirmation of the new regime, that even the kids themselves
accept
it. But he's not there. And at this point, there's a trace reference, which we'll come to perhaps after the break, of him in captivity. But at this point, the princes themselves effectively leave the story. So this is the point, I think, at which we should take a break, and we can return after the break and we will be solving the mystery of the princess in the tower. Welcome back to The Rest is History. We are poised to solve the mystery of the princess in the tower. So Richard III has been crowned on the 6th of July. His two nephews did not turn up at the coronation. We know that summer they are seen playing in the gardens at the Tower of London complex. A prison is part of it, but it's not just a prison. It's a kind of royal complex. They are seen practicing archery. There is talk of faces at windows. But at some point that summer, their household servants are dismissed, and then they are never seen again. So, Tom, I mean, it's the key question. What happens to them?
So we've got the question from Megan Young. Do you think the princes were murdered, and if so, when and by whom? I would have thought the overwhelming probability is that they were murdered and that it was done on Richard's orders. And absolute certainty on this obviously is impossible, because otherwise people wouldn't be debating it to this day. So we're not going to solve it, because no definitive solution is ultimately possible. But I think the overwhelming probability is that they were murdered and Richard did it. So let's look at the other candidate.
Go on then. Yeah.
The other major
There's really only one candidate, I would say, other than Richard, wouldn't you?
Which would be Buckingham.
Yeah, agreed. So Buckingham is Constable of England. He has been rewarded. So he might conceivably have access to the tower.
Yeah, because that's very the key,
hard,
isn't it? That's the
very
key.
Very hard have access? To see how he has access without Richard's knowledge. Because Richard is the king. His men control everything. So to me, it's hard to see how Buckingham... And also... So Buckingham is the... We open this episode with a quotation from The Daughter of Time by Josephine Tay. And in Josephine Tay's book, her detective, Alan Grant, is laid up in hospital with a broken leg, and he falls to solving the mystery of the princes in the tower. And he reads all the evidence and he decides that Buckingham did it. And Richard's enthusiasts have often thought that Buckingham did it. So there's a really brilliant book, which I loved when I was about 12, a great sort of biography of Richard III, the probably the definitive one for a lot of Ricardians, by American academic called Paul Murray Kendall. And he has this big appendix in which he also thinks that Buckingham did it. And he sort of says Buckingham was playing a long game. He had his eye on the throne. He probably acted without Richard knowing. He had access to the tower. I ultimately find that a bit implausible. I think Richard is so clearly the man in charge.
Yeah.
And he's the obvious person with most to gain.
And again, I mean, it would be like if Buckingham were responsible, it would be in the way that Richard would have been responsible for the murder of Henry VI, i.e. not ultimately, because it was Edward IV. The buck stops with the king.
Yeah.
And
the sort of counter-argument, the counter-argument is, Tom, that Richard is weakened by the deaths of the two boys because people hold it against him. And he doesn't immediately gain anything by it. But I would say, in answer to that, there is the first revolt, isn't there, in late July. So mm-hmm. within a month of his coronation,
yeah.
there is an attempt by some conspirators to rescue the two boys
yeah.
and to stage a sort of pro-Woodville counter-coup.
Yeah.
And, I mean, everything you know about thousands of years of history is that when that kind of thing happens, the person in charge decides, usually, will get rid of the focus of resistance.
Yeah.
You know, get rid of the alternative candidates. That's what dictators, kings, emperors have done throughout all history. So it would make complete sense for Richard at that point to say, oh my God, they've got to go. I can't keep having these revolts. And I don't think that's because he's evil and malignant. I just think that's because
he's hard-headed.
It's realpolitik.
The calculus of power.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that militates against the idea that Buckingham did it is that Richard actually had the perfect... I mean, the problem for Richard is that people are starting to say they've been murdered. So the obvious way to counter that is to produce them.
Yeah.
So if you can't produce them, that is very, very suspicious, I think. If they're dead, you can't produce them, then obviously the idea would be to try and blame someone for it. And the ideal opportunity takes place when Buckingham, who has not been rewarded as he feels... fit joins in a rebellion that aims to bring Henry Tudor the only conceivable Lancastrian claimant to the throne. And this revolt is defeated. Buckingham is captured. He is taken to Salisbury. He is taken to a courtyard between the Blue Boar Inn and the Saracen's Head Inn. Off with his head, so much for Buckingham, in the famous cry of Richard III in Shakespeare's play. And Buckingham's head is severed in, I think I've already mentioned this, what becomes the laundry department of Debenhams in Salisbury, which has sadly since closed.
A lovely detail.
But for a long time, you know, you'd go in to buy a bra and Duke of Buckingham would pop up carrying his head.
Well, you know what Richard said about Buckingham's rebels? He said they were horrible adulterers and bawds. So in a way, they're kind of ladies' underwear department of a mid-market department
very,
store.
Very fitting.
Makes complete, So
Buckingham's died a traitor. So it's the perfect opportunity for Richard to say, Buckingham did it.
Yeah.
But he doesn't.
No, he doesn't. I mean, the other candidate that sometimes people... So I've been to the Richard III Experience, or whatever it's called, in Leicester. And you can vote. There's a sort of interactive element where you can vote about who you think did it. Richard, Buckingham, or Henry Tudor. And some people say Henry Tudor killed them. Very, very ardent Ricardians sometimes say this. But again, I think that's very, very implausible. Because I think...
Well, Margaret Beaufort, his mother, is another candidate, isn't it?
What have they been doing in the... what have the kids been doing in the interim?
Well, I'll tell you the other thing about Margaret Beaufort, who's Henry Tudor's mother, is that she reaches an accommodation with Elizabeth Woodville, who's still in sanctuary. And the only conceivable reason for that is that they would both, that they would have for that is that Elizabeth Woodville assumes that her children are dead.
Although, Tom, there is an interesting problem with the Richard III, the explanation that places Richard III as the murderer. And that is that Elizabeth Woodville also reaches an accommodation with Richard herself. So in March 1484, she leaves sanctuary. And then reappears at court, which is a kind of slightly weird thing to do.
It's
if
not.
She thinks her sons have... Well, I suppose
it's
your
not.
Argument would be
it's
she
not
feels she has no choice.
She's also thinking about her daughter. She doesn't want to be... she's assuming, I guess, that it's likely that Richard will carry on. I mean, she's trying to play both... she's reaching accommodation with Margaret Beaufort to try and reach out to Henry VII, as he will become, that he will marry her daughter, Elizabeth, which in due course is, of course, exactly what happens. But she's also kind of, what's my fate going to be? What's the fate of my other children going to be under Richard?
Well, it's quite clear that a lot of people think that, I think it's quite clear that by that point, most people think that the princes are dead because the anti-Ricardian forces have moved their focus to Henry Tudor.
And you're starting
which
to
they
get,
wouldn't have done otherwise.
And you're starting, so the rumours that Thomas More picks up on, and which then ultimately feed into Shakespeare's play, which are, they're originating in this period. And they are that Brackenbury, who's the Constable of the Tower of London, has refused to kill the princes, that it's been done by a guy called Sir James Tyrrell, who is played in the Ian McKellen film by Adrian Dunbar.
All right, very good.
So Ted Hastings.
Head of AC-12.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Bent Copper goes in and does it. And that they're smothered by pillows. So that's the story that Thomas More will pick up. Or they're poisoned. Or interestingly, that they're drowned in a butt of Malmsey, which seems
again sort of
unoriginal.
They're not going to do that again,
doesn't it? So I guess what all those rumours suggest is that people don't actually know what's happened, which is of course what you'd expect.
And interesting, Tom, is that Henry VII, when he finally defeats Richard at the Battle of Bosworth, he doesn't really make a huge deal about the princes, does he?
Well, he doesn't want to, does he? Because
he's worried about his claim.
He's worried about his claim. So, he's going to marry their sister, and that's going to be, by that point, so initially he's kind of adopted as the Yorkist candidate, but he doesn't want to rule as the Yorkist candidate.
Yeah.
He wants to park the whole issue. So everything is focused on saying Richard III was evil. He was a dog, all that kind of stuff. Stick a knife in his bare buttock when he's dead, all that kind of thing. But you just part. Everybody has an interest in letting dead princes lie, and I think that's the issue. And I think the conclusive proof that Henry VII didn't murder them is that in due course, when you start to get pretenders,
right? Well, this is the thing, they don't lie.
He's
do
in
they?
A genuine panic. I mean, he I thought they were dead.
Yeah. Well, so what's really interesting about this is they don't disappear. Now, you have a parallel, actually. So people who know about Russian history will know that after Ivan the Terrible, there was something called the Time of Troubles. And there were all these people called false Dmitries, who Dmitry was the youngest son of Ivan the Terrible, who had died. And one of the false Dmitries, one of these pretenders, actually ends up ruling Russia for a couple of years or a year or so. So imposter pretenders are very common in history, especially at times of uncertainty and instability. And Henry Tudor is very unstable. I mean, no one knows that Henry Tudor is going to last a long time, do they? And actually, the Wars of the Roses don't really end in 1485.
No,
because
they carry on.
I mean, first of all, just 2 years after he's taken power, you get Lambert Simnel. Now, Lambert Simnel, bizarrely, is not impersonating one of the princes in the Tower. He's impersonating the son of Clarence, who is, what is he, the Earl of Warwick.
Yeah.
The young Earl of Warwick. And there's a battle at Stoke Field with Lambert Simnel's forces. I mean, he's only 10, but the forces representing him, which is actually bigger than the Battle of Bosworth.
Yeah.
But it's completely unknown because the result is not.
But so there's him and then there's Perkin Warbeck. And yeah. What's kind of interesting is that originally Lambert Simnel claimed to be Richard of Shrewsbury and then changed his mind and became the Earl of Warwick.
Yes.
And with Perkin Warbeck, it was the other way round. That initially he complained to be the Earl of Warwick and then claimed to be Richard. And he was basically sponsored by Margaret of Burgundy, so Edward IV's sister.
And he's a Belgian, isn't he, Perkin Warbeck? He's one of life's world's famous Belgians.
Yes.
Hercule Poirot.
Or was he?
Well, no one really knows. Some people think he came from a place called Tournai.
Horace Walpole and Philippa Gregory...
They think he is.
They both thought he really was Richard of Shrewsbury, which if he was, it was, you know, sad fate. Well, I mean, sad fate for Perkin Warbeck as well, because he wasn't very successful. He tried to land at Deal, couldn't manage that, got beaten off, went to Ireland, went to Scotland, gave up, tried again, landed in Cornwall, ran away, got captured.
Yeah.
Got looked after about 2 years and then got hanged.
But then he is executed with the little Earl of Warwick, the younger Earl of Warwick, Edward Earl of Warwick, isn't he? So they're either impersonating him or they're being executed alongside him.
It's all very confusing. I mean, lots of great novels and dramas and whodunits around that theme.
But then in 1674, there seems to be an answer to the mystery, doesn't there?
We've got a question from Dr. Sushma Jansari, very distinguished curator at the British Museum, who I hope will be coming on the show, who asks, what's with the bodies of children found in the Tower? Have I preempted you?
No, that's exactly it. 1674, some bodies are found, some bones are found, and they're identified as the two boys, and Charles II orders them buried in Westminster Abbey, doesn't he?
And he says here lie the relics of Edward V, King of England, and Richard, Duke of York.
But I think it's the general consensus now that they're probably not.
They got re-examined in 1933, and they're incomplete skeletons, and there's quite a lot of animal bones.
Yeah.
So again, this goes
back to that thing about the Tower. The Tower is this big, sprawling complex at the time.
Yeah.
There's lots of different buildings. So there's probably a lot of different people buried in the grounds. There's no reason to believe that these are necessarily the princes. And I think the Queen has refused permission for them to be.
Well, more tantalizingly, did you know about the discovery at St. George's Chapel in Windsor?
Oh, I did see something about this,
which is really intriguing. So there were workmen working there, and that's where Edward IV and then in due course Elizabeth Woodville have been buried together. And they accidentally knock through into the crypt, and they find that there's another adjacent crypt, and there are the bodies of two children in it. And the names on the coffins are two of Edward IV's children who had predeceased him. But they've been buried elsewhere.
Yes, I did see that. That's mysterious, isn't it? But Tom, is there not an even more exciting possibility, recently featured in Her Majesty's Daily Telegraph?
Indeed. I don't know whether people saw this. This is, again, part of Philippa Langley's lifelong project to prove.
So to be fair to her, she did find the body of Richard III in the car park. So she has form.
She does have form. And She is a keen supporter of something called, according to Telegraph, the Missing Princes Project, which is led by someone called John Dyke. And Telegraph reports him as saying, the idea of a missing prince lying low in Devon might appear fanciful at first. With all the secret symbols and clues, it sounds somewhat like the Da Vinci Code. But the discoveries inside this church in the middle of nowhere, so that's in the middle of Dartmoor, end of a lane, are extraordinary. The evidence suggests that Edward was, so that's Edward V, so the elder of the princes. And it's interesting, I think, Dominic, that all the pretenders, none of them are Edward V. They're all kind of Richard.
Well, probably because he was too well known at the age of 12.
Yeah.
So you can't impersonate him.
So the evidence suggests that Edward was actually sent to live out his days on his half-brother's land as long as he kept quiet, as part of a deal reached between his mother and Richard III and later with Henry Tudor. Once you take all the clues together, it does appear that the story of the princes in the tower may need to be rewritten.
Well, you know what he would call himself, according to this? John Evans.
And there's
he built his own chantry, didn't he, at the age of 41, and he put lots of clues to himself.
Well, among which, that on his tomb, of course, if you look, Evans, what are the first two letters of Evans?
E-V.
E-5.
Oh, extraordinary. So well, do you believe this, Tom?
I'm not entirely convinced.
I'm not convinced.
I mean, when John Dyke says that it sounds somewhat like the Da Vinci Code, I think that's not inaccurate.
I mean, basically, let me just address the central implausibility. Is it plausible that Richard, who we know is so hard-nosed,
and Henry VII, is and so
ruthless,
a bastard.
Two incredibly ruthless men who have a track record of executing their enemies, which is why they're able to become king in the first place, that they would agree a deal to allow their biggest rival to go and live under an assumed name on Dartmoor, and that he then, in his turn,
would leave lots of clues.
Yeah, would never surface and try and recapture the crown, but would build a load of clues into the church. I think that's stranger things have happened, but not many. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, Philippa Langley, you know, she was right with the car park, so.
She was. She
who
was
knows?
Indeed. Yeah. She'll be laughing at us one day, Tom, in that Channel 4 documentary proving that Edward V.
I know.
Play bits of this podcast. They were kind of montage of our shamed countenances.
Oh, dear. Anyway, Ping Pong on the Discord asks, why are we still interested in this mystery murder over so many others?
Well, that's a very good question.
And I think, actually, it is because there are just... A final solution, I think, isn't... I shouldn't use the word final solution, should I? The kind of a conclusive solution is not possible. Because,
yeah, agreed.
You know, there's not enough
evidence. We can't
evidence.
Be... I but mean, even just, though we both think that
Richard did
it. There's
enough evidence to construct all kinds of various possibilities. Plus, of course, it involves kings and princes.
But also, clearly, there's a romantic element, isn't there, to the last Plantagenet, to Richard III, which encourages Ricardians to find him innocent. So there's this sort of notion, isn't there, that the medieval period comes to a kind of crashing end at the Battle of Bosworth.
Plus, Henry VII is kind of accountant, a grim accountant.
The age of knights and stuff is gone, and it's replaced by, exactly, this sort of miserable penny pincher and then his whale of a son. And that people romanticise the age that went before the Plantagenets. They romanticise Richard, of course, because he's the guy from the north. He's very religious, all of this sort of stuff. And I think then there becomes this urge to find him innocent. And also to think, I would say, to think that you have discovered the key to history.
Yeah.
And something that academics haven't spotted and all this sort of stuff.
I think... I'm just wondering about this. This just thinking aloud here. I wonder also if a part of it isn't sublimated hostility to Shakespeare.
I didn't see that coming.
No, well, there is actually kind of rather similar stuff around the identity of Shakespeare. You know, was he the Earl of Oxford or
that's
whatever?
True. That's true.
So there's a question here. Ollie Oko again on the Discord. Was Shakespeare's reputation slipping circa 1593 and he needed a sycophantic pro-Tudor play to keep the Queen happy and boost his
standing in
court?
There's somebody who doesn't like Shakespeare.
Yeah, so I think that this idea that Shakespeare is a kind of, he's either, he's a fraud who is taking the credit that probably belongs to an aristocrat, or that he's a kind of sinister, conniving sycophant. It kind of, Maybe if you had a bad time studying him at school or something, it's a way to kind of elbow him aside.
It's not just a hostility to the received wisdom in general and to sort of the idea of
authority. I think it's a part of that. And I think Shakespeare is kind of, you know, as the greatest writer.
Yeah.
There's a kind of pleasure in kicking him.
I think there's definitely a lot of people who get a lot
of pleasure. And also Thomas More. So in The Daughter of Time, Thomas More is absolutely the villain. You know, you get that in, you know.
Hilary Mantel.
Yes, exactly.
She thinks so, Thomas More is the villain.
So Thomas More and Shakespeare are both, you know, people who've been so eulogised that there's a kind of seditious pleasure in,
yeah, I think that's definitely true,
giving them a kicking. But I also think that Richard's obviously been unlucky in Shakespeare because it's a brilliant play. The Ian McKellen, have you seen the...
fantastic. Set in World War II type.
It's kind of 1930s.
A bit like the production of Beckett that I did at the Edinburgh yes. Festival, Tom.
Yes, it all becomes fascist. I think there's a kind of way in which you could cast Richard as a kind of Raul Castro, or, you know, the brother of, you know, an autocrat, or, you know, one of the al-Assads, or someone who, after the charismatic founder of the regime has gone, has to be ruthless. To keep his regime in power, and to keep
Jim Callaghan to Edward IV's Harold Wilson.
Yeah, that's the other way.
Is that the comparison you were looking for?
That's the comparison that I was groping for. I'm glad that you've provided it.
Well, he's Robert Kennedy to JFK, I think. I think he's more serious. He's the dutiful younger brother who finds himself pushed suddenly into the limelight.
But Robert Kennedy didn't.
Didn't murder any children.
Didn't murder.
No,
his
I mean,
nephews.
That's true.
Well, but then we don't. We can't conclusively say that Richard did.
No. I think, Tom, I'm very sympathetic to Richard. But even though I think he probably did kill the princes in the tower, I think he's in a really, really difficult position, and he's trying to make the best of it. And of course, killing your nephews is not normally the most admirable way out. But I think to be brutal about it in that world,
he had no choice.
His choice is probably to keep taking these kind of bloodstained acts,
but to
lose the game.
But he did lose the game, and he lost the game not just for himself, but for his entire family.
Yeah,
the Yorkists should have. You know, there was a plenitude of sons and daughters. They should have. You know, the 16th century should have been the Yorkist age. And the fact that it wasn't.
Do you think
Richard could have taken very, very different decisions?
The interesting thing is that had it been the Yorkist age, I mean, this is indulging in a colossal counterfactual, which I know we've poured scorn on in earlier podcasts, the idea of counterfactuals. But a secure Yorkist regime, in a Plantagenet regime, in the mid-16th century, I would say is much less likely to break with Rome and to encourage the growth of Protestantism.
Although,
and it's partly Henry VIII's insecurity,
although it's obvious that... you know, having unsuitable marriages is something that Edward IV is capable of passing on to his descendants.
Yeah.
So who knows?
Well, that's true.
I mean, maybe,
that's true.
Maybe
another. So maybe
one.
His grandson or some successor would have been Henry VIII in a different guise.
So I do think Richard is a tragic figure, and not for the reasons that Shakespeare makes him a tragic figure. He's not a kind of out-and-out villain. I think he perhaps for reasons that ultimately he's unable to control, he destroys himself and...
Yeah,
his family and his regime, and he's a massive loser.
Harsh, Tom Holland.
He's a murderer and a loser.
Yeah, very harsh. I shall leave you to field the correspondence with the Ricardians when the podcast is over. Please address your complaints to Tom, and not to me.
So, who do you think murdered the prince in the tower, Dominic? Before we go,
well, I think Richard did it, but I think he was right to do it. That's the difference.
But he wasn't right. He immolated his regime.
Well, if he'd won at Bosworth, if he'd won at Bosworth, it would
he
have been right.
He didn't, did he? He didn't, because nobody backed him.
Well, he was pretty close at Bosworth. I mean, it was very much a, you know, it was a bit like Aston Villa's exit from the FA Cup last night, Tom. It could have gone either way. Sorry, I know that's a sore point. Right. Thank you very much. We will see. What will we see them for next?
Railways. History of the railways. Beginnings of the railways.
Very exciting. Dan Jackson, I believe, may be wearing a hat.
He does, but of course you won't be able to see that.
No, but you'll know that it was there.
Yes. All right, so we'll see you then. Thanks very much for listening. And don't forget that Dominic also thinks that Richard murdered the princes in the tower. So address all correspondence to both of us. Thanks.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.